I'm Christopher Busby. I'm a global expert. I'm a professor of chemical physics, and I'm a global expert on the health effects of ionizing radiation, although I've done various other things as well. And for a time, I was the science and technology speaker, the shadow minister, I suppose you'd call it, of the Green Party of England and Wales. But that was up until about 2009 or 10. And I disappeared from the Green Party after George Monbiot started attacking my science. But anyway, since then, I've continued to work on the health effects of ionising radiation as the scientific secretary of the European Committee on Radiation Risk, which is a group of independent scientists that assembled in Brussels in 1998. With the assistance of the Green Group in the European Parliament at that time. And since then, we published two, well, more than two, but certainly two reports which show how to calculate the downstream health effects of exposure to ionizing radiation. And we're mainly concerned about internal ionizing radiation, which is stuff like plutonium-239 and cesium-137, and the sort of stuff that comes out of nuclear power stations and the sort of stuff that falls on the ground after atomic testing.
Now,
Right. Well,
your
I have one important piece of.
just before we get launched into your news, I just think we need to just understand what happened. Something happened in the Green Party. We're now effectively got a Green Party that embraces nuclear power. So you talked about this spat with Monbiot, George Monbiot, the Guardian columnist. Could you just tell us a bit about that change in direction with the Green Party? Because I think many people are looking at the Greens now and saying, I mean, looking at the German Greens too, and saying, well, they've renounced their roots, really.
Yes. Well, the problem with the Green Party is that there was a real Green Party long ago. But in the early 2000s, it started to move in a slightly different direction, which became more and more, I suppose, how would you say, conventional and less radical. And of course, at that time, I was and still am on the radical wing. In fact, I've left the Green Party now for reasons basically today to do with all of this issue of nuclear power. I mean, the Greens pretty much started as anti-nuclear with Petra Kelly and those people, and they remained anti-nuclear. But somehow in the period after 2000, they became obsessed with global warming. And global warming, I always thought, and many people have thought, the idea of global warming was sold as a way of developing nuclear energy, because at that time the Chinese were beginning to be very important economically, and the Chinese got their energy from coal, and coal produces carbon dioxide. So all of this concentration on nuclear as a solution to the world's energy problems, which was, of course, spun tremendously by the nuclear industry, that moved into the Green Party through people like George Monbiot, who really doesn't know anything about science. I mean, he's not a scientist. You know? He doesn't understand these things. And whether or not he was actually paid to do this, or he was part of some conspiracy or whatever it was, he increasingly. Well, he started, first of all, he changed his mind about whether nuclear was good or not, and he decided to embrace nuclear as an extra, no, not as a method of dealing with the problems of global warming, which he saw as very serious. And in fact, I'm sitting here in France at the moment. The temperature has been 40 degrees here. I'm in a boat on the canal, so I can jump in the canal, but it really is extremely hot, and it doesn't look like it's going to get any less hot. And there's no rain. It hasn't been rained for a very long time. They're pumping the canal water and the water from the River Loire, which is just down the road here, about a kilometre from me, which is pretty much empty. And they're pumping all that water into the nuclear power station at Belleville to keep it cool. So the French have big problems with their nuclear because of that. But back to Monbiot. Round about the time of Fukushima, of course, everybody was saying that we can't have nuclear because it's going to kill everybody, because there's going to be accidents like Chernobyl and Fukushima and so forth, and people are going to all die of leukemia and various other diseases, cancer and so forth. And actually, they were right to think that. They were right to think that. But what happened was that Monbiot came along in The Guardian, and he attacked me as being a phony scientist. And at that time, I was pretty much the top end of the opposition, the scientific opposition to nuclear. And since then, of course, and then after that, everybody just stopped dealing with me. You know, I was considered to be some kind. I became a sort of scientific outcast, and to some extent, that's still the case. But so that's the not Monbiot. So Monbiot's reason for attacking me was bogus. And I tried to argue with them. I tried to argue with the Guardian, but they wouldn't let me have any space to argue. But truly, it was I complained to the press complaints people and all the rest of it, but nobody would allow me to respond to what it was that Monbiot was saying. And what Monbiot was saying was, of course, backed up by a load of bogus nuclear industry funded scientists like Georgine, like George, what's her name, that Thomas woman. Anyway, so it's a long story, but basically, since Monbiot, since sort of 2011, when he had his Pauline conversion to nuclear, I have been sort of off the map for the Greens, and it's really been quite tragic, really. I mean, and it continues, but of course, behind it all, I have been continuing in my role as the scientific secretary of the European Committee on Radiation Risk. And in 2010, just before Fukushima, I was the editor of the second report of the ECRR, which was published, and is still available. And this is the story now. The story now is that between 2011 and today, a huge amount of scientific evidence has emerged to show that the radiation risk model, that is the basis for all of the legal limits relating to people living near nuclear sites, or people who've given CAT scans, or just generally exposure to radiation, it wildly incorrect, and the consequence of that has been the deaths of an awful lot of people. I mean, the calculation gives between 300 million and I know it's hard to believe, between 300 million and 500 million people have died of cancer as a result of exposure to radioactive contamination. Anyway. Being here in France over the last year, really, I have assembled a new load of evidence relating to this issue, which proves scientifically, and cites a load of scientific documents and research documents and so on, which are increasingly emerging, that show that this is the case and that the current radiation risk model is wildly incorrect and all these people are dying. And so the result of this is that, of course, what governments should do is they should knock nuclear on the head. But, so that's the position at the moment. And this document is now finished. It's called the 2026 report of the European Committee on Radiation Risk. It's about 260 pages with lots and lots of references and lots of arguments and lots of numbers that enable people to calculate how many children or how many adults or anybody, any individual who's exposed to a particular amount of radiation, which you can measure, and we can say what the probability of those people getting cancer is. And the result of this model is that it turns out that about one third of all of the cancers in the West, I mean, I'm talking about, well, on the globe, really, but one third of all the cancers that have occurred since about 1980 have been a consequence of exposure to the radioactive contamination produced at the time of the nuclear weapons testing between 1955 and 1965. And this could be proven. So in this book, in this risk model, I mean, the committee, I mean, and I, it's not just me. I mean, I have a lot of scientists that I communicate with and I deal with, and we discuss these things and so on. What we have as a committee decided is that there should be compensation paid to people, and this is it, this is in the report too, that people who develop cancer should have a pension. They should have a cancer pension on the basis that the government didn't have a sufficient duty of care to investigate the causes of, the radiation causes of cancer associated with the fallout and with the exposures from nuclear sites like Hinkley, in fact. Because, I mean, we did a study at Hinkley that showed that there's a doubling of risk in breast cancer, and there's an increased risk of leukemia, and there's an increased risk of mortality associated with contamination emerging from that has emerged from Hinckley and blown across to Burnham-on-Sea, and of course gone up the River Parret and so on. So all of those areas around there that are close to the mud banks are associated with an excess risk of cancer, and that is the core. That is the what's the word? That is the people who are responsible for that are the nuclear industry and the government. But they won't take responsibility because they say that that they have a risk model which shows the right answer, and that shows that nobody could have died of cancer because they're living close to the nuclear site. I mean, we know since 1980s that the children living near Sellafield, for example, have a tenfold excess risk of leukemia. But that went into court, and they said, oh, well, the dose is too low, so it can't be the radiation, must be something else, and so on. Anyway, all of this is discussed inside this 260-page report, which we are going to have printed and distributed, and it's going to be sent out to everybody. And certainly it's going to be sent to the Green Party movers and shakers, and let's see what they do. Because what they should do is they should turn against nuclear and say, we can't continue to do this. Of course, if we need it for energy, because the energy is basically screwed, we can't get any gas, we can't get any oil and so forth, and we have to survive, then we can have nuclear. But then you have to pay people who get cancer as a result of the nuclear pollution. That's the obvious answer for society. So we say, all right, so we have to have nuclear because there's no other way of generating electricity in order to keep warm, let's say. This is a political argument. It's a utilitarian argument. Okay, so we say some people have to be warm, other people have to die of leukemia. But then what you do is you take the people who are dying of leukemia and you say, right, you're going to get £1 million because you've got leukemia as a result of something that we've done, which we believe to be good for society. And it's tough luck on you, of course, but you're getting a lot of money. And that's how it should be done. And that's one of the chapters in this book. It's all calculated how much they should get, depending upon when they get the leukemia and, whether it's later in life or the breast cancer or whatever it happens to be. And we take a proportion of of their life that they've got the cancer or the leukemia, and we pay them a pension. And basically, the nuclear industry should pay them the pension because they're the people
Well,
responsible.
neither the government nor the nuclear industry are going to like this, are they? They're both minted, and it's, against one guy in a boat.
Well, I mean, the truth is the truth. Tony, I mean, and this, that, so they obviously they can do that, but the people have to think. I mean, assuming the people are interested, which I assume they are. I mean, I haven't given up on that. And also, there are people in the government that are, I believe, honest, right? I believe so. I mean, recently I had a long conversation with the Environment Agency, and in fact, they wanted to interview me after the conversation, after I went to their meeting and I asked various questions. They got back to me and they said, can we interview you? And I said, all right. I was on the boat. And so they said, we want to interview you for an hour. So I thought, okay. And they said, we're going to take this interview and we're videoing it and we're going to use it. Is that all right? I said, yeah, sure. But then what I didn't tell them was I was going to interview that I was going to video them. Okay. So they were videoing me and I was videoing them. So I've got the video of that interview, and I'm going to put that up on the internet, and people can see the sort of people that are making these decisions. They can see that they're, well, I won't say stupidity, but they're, what's the word? Their sort of level of understanding. Because I have to say, all the people who are involved in this Great British Nuclear and the Atlantic Partnership and the small modular reactors and all of this stuff that they're going in for now, these people are really quite, what's the word? They're really quite ordinary and not very clever technical people, like PowerPoint people, what I would call them, So they're good at making PowerPoints and talking to people and trying to
Yeah, well, there
persuade
was
them
a
that they're
very good
right.
PowerPoint for Hinckley C, apparently. There was a very good
I'm
PowerPoint
sure.
for HS2.
Of course, and these people are responsible for it, But I looked them all up on the internet. I mean, there are about four of them that I chose. These were the people at the meeting where they were presenting all this nonsense. And I looked them up. Of course, there are their names there, and you can see who they are, and you can go on the internet and you can find out where they come from and what sort of degrees they've got and all of that stuff, And what I found is that all of those people were more or less walked out of school. In fact, they didn't have PhDs. One of them did. Most of them just had degrees in something or another. And then they came into the nuclear industry in 2003. All of them, the whole lot. Okay, 2003, 2004, all four of them. And really, they don't know anything. That's the problem. Now, and as I said to them in my interview, and it's all recorded, and I'll stick it up on YouTube. What I said to them is that you are the sort of glass plates between the government's decisions and the people's desires. And so you pretend to administer the system so that nobody dies, and they sort of pretend to believe you. I mean, that's on the people side of it, okay? And that's how it is. But the problem is these people don't know anything. And I said, well, do you actually go and ask anybody about whether these rules that you, these regulations that you administer, do you ask anybody about, do you investigate whether they're right or wrong? Do you look on the literature to see whether they're right or wrong? I mean, recently, for example, recently there were three epidemiologists from Harvard, and they did a study that should have been done for many, many, for the last 20 years, but nobody did it. And they looked at people living near nuclear sites in America. So they took all of the nuclear power stations in America. And you can get data on zip code on cancer in America now. Since about 2015, you could do that. I've done a few of these studies myself for court cases. And so what you can do is you can compare people living near nuclear power stations with people who are not living near nuclear power stations. This is a very simple epidemiological study. And lo and behold, what they found, and it's been published in the last 6 months, these Harvard guys. They found that people living near nuclear power stations have about 50% excess risk of cancer to people who don't live near nuclear power stations. So, I mean, so that means that the Environment Agency, when they pass, all the laws, when they pass the applications of people who are operating Hinkley Point or Capenhurst or wherever it happens to be where they're going to do something like this. The new small modular reactors, they're going to put one. I think they are going to do that as well. Then those people who want to put the modular reactor there, they write some sort of report about what they're going to do and how much stuff is going to be released and what the contamination is. They send that to the Environment Agency. These guys in the Environment Agency then look at the problem and they tick the box and it goes ahead. And I say to them, well, why do you, on what basis do you think that these levels of contamination are safe? And they say, oh, because of the International Commission on Radiological Protection. And I say, but that's been shown to be wrong by so many studies. And they say, oh, well, it's not our business to investigate it. But I said, but it is your business to look after the health of people who are exposed to these substances. Anyway, so that's where we are. We're in a kind of sort of
Yeah, it's
impasse
like death
situation
by
that involves all of
bureaucracy,
that.
really. But look, you talk, I mean,
Yeah,
I
of
can
course.
totally understand how looking at radiation around a nuclear power station is a very good indication of cancer. But you said something different. You said this is all related to nuclear testing in the 1950s. How do
Yes.
you prove that?
But what. Both of those things. Well, I'd proved it very easily. In fact, two of my colleague in America has done the same study. What you do is you look at the areas of America. America's easy to do because you can get the data. In England, you can't get the data very easily. They keep it secret. But in America, what you can do is you can look at areas of high rainfall and high strontium 90, which are all measured. It's all regular. It's all written down, so you know where these places are. So, for instance, if you go to California, New Mexico, Arizona, those areas in the time of the weapons testing, 1955 to 1965, they had very little fallout. The weapons fallout, they had very little weapons fallout. And if you go to places where there's high rainfall on the southwest, on the southeast, so that's Tennessee, Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, Kentucky, those places where it rains a lot. You get a lot more strontium 90 from the fallout. And it's been measured. So it's not as if you're sort of guessing that. The measurements were made of baby teeth. So in the 60s, they took a load of deciduous teeth from children and they measured the strontium 90 in the deciduous teeth. I used some of that data in a court case in Florida. Anyway, so what you do is you say you split these into two groups. You say high fallout group, this is Kentucky, Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, and you say low fallout group, Arizona, New Mexico, California, blah blah. Okay, four places, and then you look at the cancer mortality rates. So you know what people deaths from cancer, and you do that by cohort year of birth. So in other words, you look at people from right the way through. Whether the numbers of cancer deaths right the way through from 1950 to 2020, okay, and you plot them in terms of when these people were born. So you make a ratio. So you say that the ratio is high fallout over low fallout. So you take all of the number of cancers in the high fallout areas per head of population. So you make a rate. And you take all of the people in the low fallout areas per head of population, so you make a rate, and you divide one rate by the other rate. So what that shows you is the excess risk of dying of cancer in the high fallout areas relative to the low fallout areas. And so then you plot that on a graph by year of birth. Okay. And on that graph, what you find, and it's in this report, incidentally, that graph, that what you find is that there's a huge peak in the excess risk of cancer, which occurs at the time of the fallout. So in other words, if you were born in 1955 to 65, you have a 50% X chance in the high fallout area of getting cancer over the low fallout area. And what that means is that amount of dose difference, because we know how much strontium-90 fell in the high fallout areas and how many fell in the low fallout areas, and you can turn that into a dose. You can say, well, the dose from strontium-90 in the high fallout areas was 3 times the dose from strontium-90 in the low fallout areas, and it was equal to 1 millisievert. Right. This is the ICRP method of calculating. But there it is, 1 millisievert. It's about equivalent to a half of the natural background radiation. But this has nothing to do with natural background radiation. It's to do with the substance strontium-90 that binds to DNA chemically, because it's like calcium. You have calcium, strontium, barium, all right? So they're all the same group in the chemistry. And so they all bind to calcium, and calcium is DNA. The DNA is a calcium backbone, calcium phosphate backbone. So, of course, if you exchange the calcium for strontium, you've exchanged the backbone of your DNA for something that's radioactive. Anyway, so that, and this is known as well. There were lots of studies done on this. There was a study done in 1963 by a Swedish guy called Luning, who looked at mice and looked at the effects of strontium-90 on mice compared to ordinary radiation from cesium-137. And he found that all of the baby mice all died with the strontium-90 at the same dose that none of them died with cesium-137. There's a huge load of this. In fact, one of these things that Monbiot attacked me over, because I said at the time of Fukushima, I said people should take calcium tablets in order to squeeze out the strontium. So if you don't have enough calcium in your body, the strontium comes in and binds to the DNA and gives you leukemia. Anyway, of course, they attacked me and they said this is all nonsense and so forth, and that I got generally dissed by
Well,
everybody
yeah,
in The
but this is a very
Guardian,
well-known
and they were
measure that can
proud.
be taken against fallout. So, for example, iodine tablets too.
Yeah, well, that's the idea. Okay, that's the idea, is that iodine tablets are taken to protect the thyroid gland. And what I was suggesting is that calcium tablets should be taken to protect the DNA. After all, the DNA is the big deal. That's where the radiation has its effect. It's the genetic mutation of DNA in the body that causes cancer. Everybody knows that. It's been known pretty much since the 1960s. So quite a reasonable thing for me to suggest that people take calcium tablets. But my goodness, you should have heard all the screaming and yelling about it.
Yeah, but that's not on, is it? Because it sounds to me as if in an age where nuclear war is looking more potentially possible than it has done, probably since the Cuban Missile Crisis, it's probably a good idea to have a few calcium pills in your medicine cabinet right now.
Absolutely, absolutely. And in fact, I think probably more important than iodine myself, because the thing with iodine is that it has a very short half-life. The half-life of iodine is very short. So if you don't get covered in iodine at the time of the explosion, which you'd have to be sitting pretty much on top of it to do, you're not going to have any problem with iodine and the thyroid gland. But you're going to have a problem with calcium because strontium's got a half-life of 30 years, right? So wherever you've had an explosion of a nuclear power station, or if you've had fallout coming from a nuclear weapon explosion or whatever, you're going to have a lot of strontium-90. And you can have a lot of, and you have a lot of strontium-90 around nuclear sites like Sellafield. I mean, they measure it. Hinkley Point, they measure it. You know, it's there.
Yeah, so this report is called the ECRR. It's the health
It's called
effect
the
of,
it,
sorry,
yeah,
the health
health
effects of
effects
low doses of ionizing
of
radiation.
ionizing. Yes, that's right, something like that. I haven't put it up yet because it's still being copy edited. Although it's finished, but I mean, you know, I've got various people looking at the, you know, dotting the I's
So
and
when will
crossing
it be published, do
the
you
T's.
think?
Well, I'm not quite sure what to do with it at the moment, Tony, because the problem is I need to get some money together to print the book part of it, and also somebody has hacked into all the various, you know, 'cause I'm under perpetual attack, you know, by the nuclear industry and their trolls, and so my websites are perpetually being attacked. And so I'm going to have to set up some method of putting it up. But it could be that in the end I'll just stick it up on ResearchGate or something like that, so people can have a look at it before it's published properly. Because you know, to be honest, I'm quite pleased to. I would be quite pleased to put it up like the ICRP did long ago, but in order to have people criticise it, I mean, it needs to go up in such a way that people can say, look, this is wrong and that's wrong, and we don't agree with this and why is that and so forth. I mean, I'm quite open to argument. I'm a scientist. I'm not somebody who's going to laying down the law like some sort of
I
diktat.
mean, you would have thought that some journal would snap this up. I mean, do you find anywhere in the world is publishing material like this? It's obviously quite important for the public to be
Pretty
able to
much
read it.
no is the answer. Pretty much no. And in fact, this takes me to another issue, is the issue of science. What is science, right? Science increasingly is what gets published by the major journals, like The Lancet and the British Medical Journal and the American Institute for Advancement of Science and various other major journals. And there are a lot of major journals, but the problem is at the moment you can't publish with these journals for two reasons. The first reason is that they have reviewers that throw anything out that they don't like, which is, and they're mostly nuclear industry people, or people who get money, or whose universities get money from the nuclear industry, or for weapons development, or whatever. But the other reason is it costs a lot of money. So to publish in a reasonable journal, you have to pay them $4,000 or $5,000, you know? And of course, people like
No,
me, we
no,
don't
no,
have
no,
that.
no, no. This is all wrong. If you're putting your effort into a peer-reviewed paper, or you're having it peer-reviewed, or an article, then they need to be paying you.
Well, of course they did to do that, but they don't. I mean, that is, I'm just telling you, this is just information for the listeners that actually you can't publish anything unless you've got about 2, 3, 4,000 pounds, dollars. And so anything that comes in from sort of like outfield, I suppose you'd call me, doesn't get published.
What
Although
about, say, China?
I have had some success, I have to say. You know, so I have some journals have said that they've actually asked me for papers and then I've sent them and they've done them for free. So I've got three or four of those.
What about China?
Yes, China. Well, this brings me to another story, really. I was approached about 2 years ago by an Iraqi guy. And he was saying, he got onto me because I'd done a lot of studies in Iraq around about 2010 in Fallujah, where there was an enormous increase in cancer and there was an enormous increase in infant mortality and there was a sex ratio effect, which shows genetic damage. So in other words, normally there's 1,050 boys to every 1,000 girls, but in Fallujah there was 800 boys to 1,000 girls. So that showed a genetic damage effect because it's a relative effect relating to the X chromosome. But okay, so this guy got onto me and he said, you know, can you help us? We want to find the cause of the cancer. And I said, well, I can help you do that. And I don't need any money to help you do it. You have to do a survey. You have to decide on an area. and you go and knock on doors and so forth. So the same study I did in Burnham-on-Sea, that one, the Hinkley Point study, which I did for parents concerned about Hinkley, PCAH. And we found at near Hinkley, we found increased breast cancer and we found increased leukemia and so on. So the study works. It's a study that goes around the cancer registries, because the cancer registries, by and large, are crooks. They just don't give you the truth. Anyway, so he said, all right. So he toddled off, and I designed a, he turned them in, got some people out there to knock on doors and find some results. Okay, so this all took quite a long time. And then eventually he tried to get the documents to me, the results. Well, somebody stole some of them on the way. But generally, I managed to get enough of the results to try and do the analysis. And I did the analysis, and what it showed was an enormously high increased risk of cancer and leukemia. And specifically, the leukemia was in over the period we were looking, which was 2024, no, 2022, 23, 24, 25. It was a 4-year period we looked in a place called Al Rafai, which is just north of Nasiriyah on the river Tigris. Anyway, so what it showed is that there were these enormous increased risks in leukemia in children who were born at the time of the Gulf War. So these people were 19 and 18 in 2022, 2023. They were born round about the time of the Gulf War. So just like the nuclear fallout, if you're exposed, in the womb or shortly after you're born, you get cancer. And they got leukemia. And the leukemia rate was enormously high. It was like 200 or something like that. And this is also what we found in Fallujah. But then I found another paper in Yemen that was published last year by some Arab guy in Yemen. And he found the same thing after the Israelis were bombing Dubai, Abu Dhabi. After they were bombing Yemen, there was an increase in leukemia in children. So the same thing. So whatever they're doing out there, whatever they're doing in Gaza and what they're doing in Iraq, what they did in Iraq and so on, is producing enormous levels of cancer. And you can be sure they're going to find that in Iraq, in Ukraine too, because these war materials, they accumulate. But the other thing we did in Iraq too is he sent me a load of hair samples. So we got 20 hair samples, or actually we got 40 hair samples. And I sent them off to Germany, where I've got a friend or colleague who does measurements on hair sample using mass spectrometry. And she was quite nervous about doing this, and she refused to do uranium isotope ratios, because the last time she did that, obviously she got into trouble. So we did that in Fallujah, and we found that there was enriched uranium in Fallujah, but she wouldn't do it this time. But what she did do is she did all of the elements. She did all 52 elements, and we found enormously high levels of heavy metal contamination, like unheardly high levels of heavy metal contamination. So the guy gets on to me and says, well, we need a paper. I said, well, you have to pay me to do that, because I've done everything so far for nothing, pretty much. And I'm sort of sitting here on a boat with no money, actually eating catfish from the canal. It's got as bad as that. I sent him a picture of me with a catfish. So he said, oh, all right, I'll pay you and do the study, and we need to have it by the end of the week. Okay, so I sat down in the heat at 40 degrees, and I did the study, wrote it all out, and sent it to him. And he then passed it on to all his mates in the Iraqi Cancer Registry, and they all freaked out. And he got back to me and said, you can't publish this. I said, well, why not? It's what we found. He said, I'm not going to permit you to publish it. It's my property, and you can't publish it. I thought, well, bloody hell. So that's the situation there. So the problem is, Tony, it's very hard to get this stuff out, whether you get it out in the literature or whatever. But this was a Chinese journal I sent it to. But even the, and I've published with them before. I published the fracking paper. I did a lot of study of fracking in Pennsylvania, and infant mortality. And we showed that the fracked counties had twice the infant mortality as the non-fracked counties. I did that with Joe
So
Mangano.
what's causing that?
That's contamination by radium of the groundwater. When they go down and they blow holes in the ground, well, the first thing is they use depleted uranium warheads to blow the holes in the ground, because they're much more efficient for fracking. But the second thing is, when they break it all up, you get huge amounts of radium, I mean, I know all about radium in groundwater because I worked for Stuart Smith for many years in America, and we used to do court cases about radium in groundwater because it comes up with the oil process water. So when they produce oil in the oil wells in Texas and all over, you know, Alabama, Kentucky, so on. I did one in, where was it, Kentucky, yeah. We win those cases. What they do to get the oil up, they push water down. So they drill a hole in the ground. In the old days, they drill a hole into the oil reservoir and then they pump water down. And of course, oil floats on top of water. So the oil comes up, and then, but also what comes up is a bit of water. And the water comes up has huge amounts of radium. You get a lot of radium, and radium dissolves in the water and it gets precipitated out on the pipes as scale. And so what they were doing is they had to clean the pipes. So they would take the pipes and drive a sort of air-driven rattler down the pipes, and it produced miles and miles and tons of white powder from the scale. And the poor buggers who did the work, they used to inhale the powder, and the people who lived in the areas used to inhale the powder, and of course they all got cancer. So that's why you've got the fracking. You've got the dead babies with fracking, and you can be sure they've got lots of cancers as well, but nobody studied that. But it's easy to study children. So they've got the fracked counties. Well, I made a map. I made a map of the counties that were fracked and the ones that were not fracked. And I painted them different reds and, you know, color, different yellows and reds and so forth, according to the level of infant deaths that they had. And it was quite obvious that the fracking was killing the babies. But that's had a lot of that was in the Chinese this Chinese journal. This is called the Journal of Environmental Science or something. It's a good journal. It's a
Is
good
it in
journal, and they only
English?
charge 1,000.
Is it in English?
No, it's based in Switzerland, I think, but but it's operated out of Peking, out of what they call it now, Beijing. Yeah.
But is it actually, can you read it in English or is it all in Chinese for the Chinese?
No. Of course, of course, you can read it in English. You know, of course you can.
Good.
If you
Okay.
type into Google "Busby fracking cancer," no, infant mortality fracking, or just "Busby fracking," it'll come up. It's had
Right.
an enormous load. I was one of the first people to show this. I mean, that my paper was, I think, pretty much the first paper that drew attention to the health effects, the effects on children of fracking. I mean, there've been quite a few have been done since then, but mine was the first one, and
But you said
it's
you've
cited
got
all over the place.
various bits of news. Have you managed to run through them yet?
No, there's only one last one. Be brief. Is that I may have told you before in another interview we had about the neutron bombs being used by Israel in Lebanon. I think I said something about that. And that we got samples from the site in Dahiya in Beirut, where the bomb that killed Hassan Nasrallah, who was the head of Hezbollah, we had some samples from there, which I sent off for analysis. And the analysis that I had done in Germany and also in Texas showed the presence of isotopes of cadmium and lead and mercury, which were anomalous, you know, which can't exist in nature. If you go around and you dig the soil up anywhere in the world, you find that there's a certain ratio of lead isotopes. Lead has three isotopes, or it has more than three, but three main ones. And they have a certain ratio. They go 1 to 1 to 2, the lead isotopes, 206, 207, 208. And there's two cadmium isotopes, 111 and 114, which also go like 1 to 2. So the 114 is twice as much as the 111. But in these samples that we found in the Nasrallah samples, we found that they were anomalous. They didn't go 1 to 1 to 2. They went 1 to 1 to 1. And that's impossible. The only way that can happen is that they have been exposed to high energy neutrons. And I wrote something about this. So the news is that I had four other samples which were got to me. They were collected by a man called Robert Gallagher, who is a really nice guy. He was a physicist, not a physicist, a philosopher. And he lived in Beirut. He was such a kind, sweet man. And we used to talk, you know, he was a bit younger than me. He was about 67 or something like that. And we really got on. And we used to talk about Aristotle and so forth, you know. He was a good laugh. Anyway, they killed him. So he got four samples. He got four more samples, and he smuggled them to me through France. So his daughter took them to France and gave them to a chap called Antoine, who was a journalist that he met when he was swimming on the beach there. And Antoine came all the way to my boat, which then was somewhere else in France, and he gave me the samples. And then I drove them all the way to Germany, and I sent them from Germany to this guy in Texas who's got this laboratory. Anyway, it didn't arrive. I hid them all like the Maltese Falcon. I hid them all in a sort of pottery present and so forth. Anyway, but eventually, well, anyway, they didn't turn up. So I thought, okay, they've been intercepted by the bad guys, you know, and that's the end of that. But then I got about 6 months later, I got a message, and I sent another load of samples to him by a different route, by somebody who actually went to America, and they never appeared. So they posted them from California, but they never got to him either. But then about a year, about 6 months, no, 6, 7 months later, suddenly he called me and he said, you know, I've got your samples. They turned up. And I said, okay, well, analyze them then. He said, yeah, sure. So he analyzed them, but then he lost the analysis. He's another kind of flaky character. But then about a month after that, he found the analysis and he sent them all to me, and I've got them here. I've only looked at them about a week ago, and what they show is exactly the same thing. They show the presence of neutron activation in the sample. They're from the same place. They're from Dahir, from where the bomb dropped. But they come at different distances. So there's some quite close to the bomb, and some a bit further from the bomb, and some quite far from the bomb. But they all show the effects of neutron activation on lead and cadmium isotopes. But the ones that are furthest from the bomb, they show the least effect.
Look,
So
hang
the
on, because
isotopic ratios.
this isn't the greatest chain of custody, is it? And maybe someone could be leading you up the garden path here.
I agree. It's possible. But then what are you to do? Is to say, oh, well, I don't really know. I mean, this guy was killed, right? He was murdered. He was shot and then run over by a boat. And then so those samples came to me, and I don't believe, I believe the guy who brought them, because he's a particular, I mean, you have to sort of believe certain people. And this guy is a particular kind of person. He's a sort of rather feeble, kind of weak kind of person, terrified of everything and so on. But it's entirely possible, Tony, okay? It could be so. It could be so, but I don't think so myself. And I looked at those samples myself, and I found uranium particles in them, okay? So
Well,
they are
I mean,
the
there is
particles
obviously the
associated.
fact that if there's nothing to see in these samples, there's no reason to kill your friend.
No, the reason to kill my friend is we had already published the fact that they had uranium in them, and there was a story by Al-Mayadeen. Al-Mayadeen took on, because one of the people involved in this team of collecting the samples was a woman who is a reporter in Beirut, and she sent the story to Al-Mayadeen, and Al-Mayadeen got onto me and said, what's going on, and so on. And also the other guy who was involved is the head of the Syndicate of Chemistry for Lebanon, a chap called Jihad Aboud. He's a professor at the Academy of Sciences, and he took the sam he got the samples, or similar, you know, the same from the same site. They were split samples. Some went to Robert and some went to him, and he sent them to France to be analyzed for uranium. He sent them to the CRIRAD laboratory in France, and then they got back to him and they said, we're not going to analyze these samples. We have already analyzed them, but we're not going to give you the results because they contain preposterous concentrations of enriched uranium, and we don't want to be involved in anything more to do with this. So that's it, stuff you.
Well, look, you know, enriched
There are lots,
uranium.
there's lots of
Enriched
background
uranium
here.
is. Could you just explain what me? Because it sounds to me as if what may be going on is you've got a conventional bunker busting weapon with a nuclear neutron bomb on the end of it. That might explain this the existence of this enriched uranium potentially.
Yeah, that's pretty much my explanation. I mean, and there was a very famous, I mean, onto this, I think I've told you before, but I got onto this long ago in 2006 or so, when I was visited by this guy Enrico Del Guidice, a physicist from Italy. came to visit me in London, and we talked about this. And he's written a book about it called The Secret of the Three Bullets. That you can still buy that book, in which he explains how this neutron bomb works. And well, not entirely, but pretty much. And then they got him as well. He also died, but mind you, he was quite old. He died under, you know, he was 70, all right. So you could say, all right, he died, you know, boo hoo. No, nobody found any bullets in him. But the other guy who wrote the book with him, called Maurizio Torrealta. So this book's by two people. It's by Maurizio Torrealta, who was the head of the Rai News TV company this was like Channel 4 in Italy. This guy. And he's the other author on this book. And so he wrote this book, The Secret of the Three Bullets. And my friend Mohammed Al-Daraji, who's one of the people I work with in Fallujah, he was a counselor in Fallujah. He told me that he was a friend of Torrealta, and so he made himself scarce. I tried to get in touch with Torrealta, but I can't get in touch with him, or he won't respond, or whatever. So all this is James Bond stuff, you know. And of course, it may be that they've made all this stuff up about the isotopes, but to be honest, I don't think so. I think that it all fits together. And so, am I to say?
Whereabouts can people follow your work, Chris? Because it's clearly, you know, that some of this is important. Many listeners will be shrugging their shoulders and saying, "Oh God, you know, they're doing it to us again, you know, in different ways," and they won't necessarily want to
Sure.
investigate the
Well, I mean,
details. But where,
I
if
can't
people
help
are
it,
interested in the
Tony.
details, whereabouts can they find this?
The easiest way is to just say Christopher Busby and stick it into the internet. So Christopher Busby radiation, Christopher Busby neutrons, Christopher Busby Lebanon, whatever.
Fracking.
In the last 6 years, I've increasingly been putting anything important that I write, including research papers, because a lot of these research papers you won't get. They won't let you have them because, you know, they go to a journal, and the journal has a sort of place where you have to pay the money to download the paper. Okay. So nearly everything that I've written is on one of two sites, which is academia.edu. So every time I do something, I stick them up on academia.edu, okay, or researchgate.net. Okay, so if you put in Chris Busby research.net, you will find pretty much all of the important papers that I've written. Like there may be 100 of them there, or on the academia, either of those things. I put them on both of them. Okay, including this thing to do with the Iraqi cancers. Although the guy says he's going to sue me if I put them up or if I don't take them
Oh
down.
God, well, this is so frustrating, isn't it? There are certain facts in science people just don't want to hear it. I can remember first coming across this low-level radiation cancer risk around nuclear power stations, I think in the early 1980s. And this was being covered by you know, World in Action, Panorama, these sorts of programs, and everyone was being told about it no longer.
I know. It's all the trouble is now, well, as you obviously know, Tony, that the media is just completely controlled now. You've only got to listen to what they say about what's happening in Eastern Europe, what's happening in Russia and Ukraine and so forth. Just complete load of spun nonsense it is.
Okay, Chris, have you got a Twitter account? And you said your website is under attack. If people want to try and find it, if it's, you know, available for a few minutes
Well,
at
yes,
some point.
the two websites that are still operational but not being the stuff on them is reasonably old, but they've still got useful stuff. And one is www.euradcom, euradcom.eu. Okay. The dot org one got hacked, and somebody wrote to us and said we can have it back if we pay them £1,500. So I said no, I haven't got that. So, but euradcom.eu has got a lot of the stuff on it. I think it's got the earlier 2010 ECRR report. The other one is Green Audit. That's been going, and I continue to keep that going. That's www.greenaudit.org. Okay. But that's also out of date. But I tell you what, in the next month or so, I'm going to turn my energy to resuscitating these accounts, and then when they are, then I'll put these books up on these accounts. My next plan is to go is to go back to Latvia and to get the book printed. I only get 500 copies of the book of the ECRR report printed.
Okay, Chris Busby, enjoying the heat or not, as the case may be. Looking forward to the rise of nuclear energy, which will, of course, halt all the global warming. Thanks very much for joining us.
You're very welcome, Tony. Thank you for asking me.